first of all, just to acknowledge you, Peter, for agreeing to do this call and sharing your time and insights from your experience. Let's see. I think I'll name first my connection with Peter and why I thought to invite him to this call. I've been studying an emerging field of psychology called SCT, system-centered therapy or system-centered training, for about the last year plus with Peter in the Bay Area before I moved out here to Philly. And I almost stumbled into it by accident. I didn't know much going in, but over time, these strong parallels between the maps of SCT, sort of the concepts it names explicitly, struck me as a parallel to and very, very similar to a lot of more implicit insights and principles that I've experienced in the service-based community. So it's been quite a while, many months now, that I've sort of imagined and daydreamed of this conversation and the rich cross-pollination that could spring from it. Peter's bio was posted online, so just to hit a few brief notes from that, Peter grew up in sort of in this context of social experiments in this country. I believe commune wouldn't be an inaccurate word, right? And sort of went to, had schooling early on in a non-traditional way, and then went into psychology, started his career in psychology, focusing in somatic psychology, and then eventually finding his way to this field of group dynamics and system-centered psych in the last 15 years or so, I think. So where I'd like to start, Peter, is just a brief introduction on what is system-centered psychology. What is it? We titled this talk "Uncovering Systems Intelligence." What do we mean by systems and intelligence, and what are the basics of SCT that distinguish it from other forms of psychology?
Yeah, thanks, Chris, and thanks for inviting me on this call. And it's great to hear the voices come in and speak to their journey to develop their passion. The thing that for me has been so powerful about discovering a systems map of human systems has been that it helped me to understand complex interactions in essential ways. And for those of you, some of you may be familiar with systems thinking, dynamic systems thinking, complexity theory, chaos theory, are some of the names that it goes by. Its origins were, and can everybody hear me okay? Is my voice clear enough? Chris, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you pretty well. It would help, I think, if you spoke up a little bit or spoke closer to the speakerphone.
I'm going to take my headset. Chris, is that better?
That's a little better, yeah. And
okay, let me try that. So systems thinking was developed in the scientific community in the 20th century when they discovered that linear thinking, linear problem solving, A causes B causes C, didn't help them understand the complexity of biological systems or things like that. So they started to look at what if we look at out further, how would we understand complexity? And from that, systems thinking was born. So scientists started to ask, what are the essential principles behind systems organizations? And one example of an essential feature of systems is that all systems seem to go through patterns of survival, development, and transformation. And so just thinking about those larger concepts helps us to think about human systems. What do we do as human beings? And systems thinking first came into psychology in thinking about family and the complexity of the family and the roles that develop in the heart of the family. That happened in the 1950s, and it wasn't until the 1980s that group psychotherapists got interested in applying systems thinking to groups, organizations, cultures, civilizations. And my teacher, Yvonne Agazarian, along with others, really started to dig in and see how they could cross-pollinate with that kind of thinking. And so by thinking about essential principles, one of the things that my teacher formulated as an essential challenge for all living human systems is the idea that systems tend to react to differences. Anything that is experienced as different under certain circumstances, there's a reaction. What often happens in human systems is that differences create conflict. And feel free, Chris, to interrupt me anytime if you have a thought or a question or a better way of saying something that I'm saying.
Mm. I'm with you.
Yeah, this essential idea about the challenge of human systems is that it could be spoken in the sentence, all systems survive, develop, and transform through the discrimination and integration of differences. So if we as a whatever system it is, two people in a marriage, a group of people working toward a common goal, if we keep noticing differences and keep integrating differences, and then we have our best shot of not getting stuck just in survival, but of moving forward to develop and finally to transform in organic ways. So this became the heart of Yvonne's theory. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, you've said a lot so far, and I just want to echo a bit back. So you've mentioned the sort of a broad map that FCT and Yvonne Agazarian specifically developed of noticing a broad trend that human groups tend to go through phases of development. First, they focus on surviving. Then they, once they have that taken care of, they can work on developing what we haven't named yet, and then sort of transforming themselves. And you've named also a basic sort of human reality that we tend to react to differences. and then you mentioned integrating the differences, and I wonder if you'd say a little bit more about how integrating differences leads from, you know, getting stuck in a survival stage to developing and transforming, and also mention the flip side of the importance of joining on similarities.
Right. So the thing that Yvonne developed out of her theory was a method of communication, and I think this will end up speaking to your question about integrating differences. And the method is, she calls functional subgrouping. And functional subgrouping is a kind of a jargon term for simply setting up a pattern of communication in a group of joining on similarities as a starting point. So if I'm leading a psychotherapy group, I'll suggest that somebody will start, and then whoever speaks next, their task is to join what the last person spoke, and then to build. So if we continue that pattern of joining and building on the what the last person said, something happens in the communication field where there's a lessening of defensive reactivity and a willingness to open up and explore. And when a group of people does that, and many of you know this in your own way, a richness develops where there's a capacity then for that group of people to begin to move past survival into development and transforming into something new. What we also know is that in any group there's also differences. And differences can be handled in different ways, so that one way to support the emergence of differences is for someone to say, hey, you know, I have a difference when this group is ready for something new. So then that person will begin something new, and they will start another subgroup. And so that new subgroup will gather spontaneous members, and it will do its work. So that we can see that in the system as a whole, there are differences. And the way that this method works is it contains the differences within an organic boundary of two subgroups. What that does is it does two things. It allows the differences to live in the space, and it allows them to be functionally separate, so that the impulse to react and take things personally, which leads to conflict, is usually significantly lowered. And then from the other side, sometimes if you subgroup long enough, you start to notice differences within a subgroup that then, if we're lucky, are at a level of integration that can then be tolerated without being reacted to. So we say learning to see the similar in the apparently different and the different in the apparently similar. And if we keep that process going over time, we will open up a field that is rich in information and possibilities for change. So that's an abstract way of talking about how systems survive, develop, and transform, and a method for doing so called functional subgrouping.
Yeah.
So let me pause there and hand it back to you, Chris.
Yeah, it's so rich, the theory, isn't it? And I join you on noticing the abstract nature of our conversation so far. So I'm pulled to toss in a concrete example. So I'm thinking of you know, someone mentioned Wednesday meditation circles earlier, and it's a simple, you know, format that the service, you know, many individuals in the service-based community choose to host you know, an hour of sitting in silence and an hour of a talking circle, and then, you know, eating a shared meal afterwards. And the talking circle in particular is, you know, serial testimony style. So everyone gets, you know, a minute or two or three, or depending on how many people are in the circle, to share their thoughts based on a passage that's read out that week. And then it goes around. And having been in many of these circles myself, I've observed something similar to what you were describing, Peter, of sort of the complexity of the system emerging over time as people don't react to each other, but they add in their own bits, you know, based on what they feel resonant with. And some people build on others. Some people start their own groups. Some people bring in different perspectives, but again, not in a reactive way that would, you know, arouse those defense mechanisms you named, Peter. So does that sound to you like a sort of simplified example of a system going through that process?
It's a lovely example of a functional communication pattern that allows some boundarying around information. So when a speaker speaks, they say what they say, and the agreement is that that person is not interrupted. That's kind of a subgroup of one. And then people then, as the system keeps going, develop complexity in response to an integration of the information that comes in. Yeah, I would join you that that does sound like a kind of subgrouping process.
Mm.
Yeah. And as we were talking about our meeting today, you also mentioned an example of something that happened for you. I don't know if you recall it, where you used the principle of subgrouping, of joining on similarities with, I think it was a student you were working with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you want me to share that story?
Yeah, if you're up for it.
Yeah, sure am.
It's nice to be concrete, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I'd love to hear stories for you if some come up too, but I am just entering this new teaching role myself here in Philadelphia. And the class is focused on interculturalism and social change, essentially. And we had one session on the social and legal constructions of race and racism. And long story short, you know, because of the experiential nature of the class, which is a very purposeful part of it, two members in particular became charged. They had strong differences, and you know, it's a dialogue-based class, so there weren't, you know, there's not a very strong structure about, you know, boundarying of information, as you were saying. You know, folks just kind of raise their hand and talk, and a lot of times that talk is present, you know, back and forth of different perspectives. You know, you think this, but I think this. So at the end of the class, we were going to have a post-class, a mini discussion, and those two members chose to come, and I suggested, hey guys, why don't we try this communication norm of just joining on similarities, and if you have a difference, hold it for later, and let the topic that was brought up resonate with whoever else can join with their own resonance. And what happened over the next 30 minutes or so was astounding to me, because the black young man who had experienced a lot of hurt based on this white man's lack of acknowledgement about continuing racism today, just listened to the white man's perspective, and I'm sorry for using white and black, this black and white, so to speak, but just for simplicity's sake. And then he said something really beautiful that, you know, at the end of it, that he had come to a place of understanding of this white man's perspective, and he attributed it to like resisting his impulse to jump in with a yeah but, and just honoring the norm of joining on similarities, or you know, letting other people join if you can't join, and sort of witnessing this other person's perspective. And he named it as a healing conversation, and that all took place within half an hour. And for me, it was astounding, because it was just this one little tweak to the communication pattern that resulted in a really profound experience for these people, and being calling it healing in an academic classroom was just amazing for me to see. Yeah.
That's a fabulous example, Chris. It's really very rich. And it's a nice example, too, about if you're thinking about the phases of group development, so that what got triggered in the group was a kind of survival energy around reactions to differences, where I presume both parties felt defensive and perhaps anxious and under attack. And what we know is that if we stay in survival, if we stay in that part of our nervous system, the fight or flight nervous system, then we boundary our capacity to take in information. And so what you describe is a beautiful example of a system going into a reaction to difference, going into personal survival, you know, survival of one's identity, of one's sense of what's important. And by slowing down, and initiating a pattern of joining on similarities, which I agree, it's a small tweak, but it's a big tweak. That's the mystery of it. Then the system was able to start to develop, to the boundaries opened to new information within these parties, and they were slowly able to find similarities, and in the end to have something that we could call transformation, a healing, something new popping out of the process. And I'll bring in another system concept that probably many of your folks on the call might be familiar with, at least in some form, and that's the property of system emergence, that out of the organic process of systems, human systems, richness emerges, just seems to come out of the process. Some of your folks who were describing some of their moments of gratitude, the emergence that happens at a dinner party or at a gathering for meditation, and so that's a beautiful, beautiful example. Mm-hmm. And in the groups that I work with, the psychotherapy groups, our goal is to really help the members go into their own communication patterns and to explore their reactivity in the service of being able to have more and more of an impact on their lives and the lives of others. So in the group, people are trained to notice when they get triggered,
and to start to identify if they get anxious and how they get anxious, and to develop tools for undoing those so that they can keep moving toward their deepest goals. One of the challenges in group dynamics is that, depending on a certain where we are, it's very common for human systems to enter into what we would call fight energy, reaction to difference, competition around goals and resources. And if we normalize that phase of fight energy and subgroup around it, we get better at managing frustration and less likely to get stuck in yes-but communication, losing energy by getting depressed or going into outrage. These are all some of the human challenges under conflict. And I imagine many of the people working in this field, their challenge comes when they're moving out into larger communities. How do they bring their work into different systems and help people identify their own survival issues and join them there? So those are some thoughts emerging for me. How about you?
Yeah. Again, a lot
actually,
of...
Actually, Peter and Chris, I wanted to actually jump in with a question, Chris, if you don't mind, just around the last point that Peter shared. Peter, and I actually realize that Chris is probably a good person to reflect on this question as well, but my question is really around different sorts of group dynamics that evolve over the course of time, and specifically, like, you know, the concept of group living, right? In college, you know, when you had a group of, you know, four people living together in a two-person place, it was something that was kind of fun. But, you know, this being the Bay Area, there's often a lot of talk around sort of building compound households, like multifamily households together. And it seems far more challenging to do that once you're sort of couples, you know, multiple couples living together and, you know, even with some kids in the mix. I was wondering if you could reflect on sort of strategies around what can keep that same enthusiasm around group living alive, and why you think it sort of gets more difficult.
That's a great question, and it's sort of the heart of what I do, what you're talking about, which is the recognition that you know, every system has its own unique resources and challenges. And some of the communities that we commit ourselves to, either to live in or to share group ideas or to accomplish certain goals, every one of those groups, is, as they come together as a system, will initiate a process of moving through phases of development. And I've talked about survive, develop, and transform. But I also have another more detailed map that talks about sort of more at the ground level what human beings tend to be challenged by. And sometimes we are lucky and there's a flow that moves us through those phases of development in an organic way, and organic solutions come up that help the group do its work, and the unique resources of people create a sense of richness and opportunity and gratitude. And, just as often, groups can hit some very challenging phases of group development. Just as an example, we know the divorce rate is 50%. And then the happiness rate in those couples that are left is maybe another 50%. So that we know that human systems very often hit a high degree of challenge in long-term development. And that's really where my passion for this work came in, where I was a member of these
various institutes and communities, and I noticed that we always, or very often, shouldn't say always, would repeat patterns of conflict and frustration and so on that were just very undermining. And groups would split or end or hit these walls. So my study of group therapy was initiated by that very thing, and system-centered therapy seemed to me to have the clearest and most positive model for negotiating those deep forces. And one of the biggest challenges of any of these or systems that we live in is what we call the authority issue. And the authority issue has to do with how do we share the work of moving toward our goals and recognizing that we're going to bump into differences, which tends to create conflict, anxiety, frustration, getting stuck in repetitive role patterns of one up, one down, compliance, defiance, victim, rescue, bully, issues with authority where the group will get frustrated with a leader and not know what to do with that frustration. And what Yvonne says is that these are the normal phases of human living. They're not bad. They're just really hard to deal with. And so what Yvonne has mapped out is a way of understanding that at each of the sub-phases of these developments, there are different developmental tasks. One of the first tasks we work to help groups get trained in is learning to be in the here and now and in the present moment and beginning to learn how we all get anxious in a group space and how to lower anxiety so that we can keep working. And then we all know that the next phase has to do with the rise of the recognition of differences that didn't seem, you know, it's like when you fall in love, you tend not to notice differences. And then if you hang in there, you start to notice that there are differences that really start to irritate you and frustrate you, and it's kind of a shock and a surprise when someone that seemed so compatible not long ago suddenly seems very incompatible. And my metaphor is if somebody tries to move your toothbrush under the wrong circumstances, you get furious with them. So that reactivity to difference just seems to be hardwired in us at the level of a relationship or in a group. So subgrouping is a method that I use in a therapy group. It's also a method that I use in a task group. A task group is a group that comes together for a common purpose. And it might be a communal living. It might be do some good work for people. It might be an organization that wants to sell something. All of those human systems have these phases of development, and subgrouping is one of the primary ways to help that happen. And normalizing our reaction to difference is also critical. We're very primed as human beings to take group dynamics personally. That person is attacking me. I've got to attack him back. Those are very personal ways of doing it. When people start to see that systems have universal phases and that, yes, here we are too, and everybody in the group shares in this experience, something profound can happen about, oh, right. This is not just about you and me. It's about what we as human beings need to learn to get to come through. And if we can get into a shared purpose about healing ourselves through exploring these phases of development rather than acting them out, then we have something. And that looks different in a therapy group than it does in a task group, but there are essential similarities. And It's a very rich, satisfying work for those people who have the place to do it. And so that's a long answer to your question. It's a great question. And did that get to some of the things you were concerned about?
Thanks for sharing that.
Chris, do you mind if I jump in here?
I would love to hear your question, and just want to resonate on one particular point first. Not a question, more of a comment that you reminded me of, Peter, which was this quote from Lao Tzu, which says, at the center of your being, you have the answer. You know who you are, and you know what you want. And I thought of that when you mentioned slowing down and this emergent property of groups, when you can tap into that, as we might be starting to do on this call.
Lovely. Yeah, thank you, yeah. Chris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jen, please.
Okay. Hi, Peter. Thank you for being on the call with us today. I was a therapist in a former lifetime, so it's always interesting to hear how other people are working. And since there are many different kinds of psychotherapies out there for people to choose from, clients will tend toward one that closely aligns with their value and belief system and personality style. So I'm wondering if you can describe for us the profile of the client who might feel drawn to the way you work.
Thank you, Jan. That's a great question. And so a lot of clients come to me who are stuck in one way or another in relationship. They're having trouble communicating with a partner. They are stuck in fights. They don't know how to get through. And so that's a very typical kind of referral that I work with. And this way of working works very well. And I would say that there's a kind of the person that works best is when they start to have an awareness that how they're communicating, how they're taking up membership in a relationship or at work is a problem. At work, for example, work dynamics can be enormously challenging for people. Submitting to an authority figure or being an authority figure and having your own authority and wielding it in a way that is compassionate and not reactive is very powerful. So in work roles, people can go into a victim, rescue, bully kind of dynamic in very, very quick terms, or get stuck in a defiant or compliant stance. And so some people who either have some inkling of that or, as we work, become aware of it, they can get very engaged in the human challenge of taking up membership in systems. I'm fortunate enough to work in different cultures, so I go to Europe a couple times a year. I've worked in other places, and it's really interesting to look at that challenge, how it shows up in different cultures. For example, in Europe, in general, the people are better at taking up membership in systems, but have a harder time finding their own authentic life energy. Okay. In the U.S., where there's more emphasis on the individual and achievement, there's more awareness of one's feelings and what one's own goals are, but a harder task to come to a shared purpose and subsume oneself into a shared task. And those aren't absolutes. There's challenges both ways in each culture. But this challenge of taking up membership, I see as a kind of a higher, if you will, development I did individual therapy for many years, and I still do, and couples work. There's something about the group space in this way of working that trains a part of the human spirit and the human brain around functioning well in a group and learning about what you do when you step into a system that impacts that system, that I don't think you can get very easily in individual therapy. And since one of the things that led me to this work was my own awareness of my limitations as a leader, that I brought plenty of challenges to the groups that I would take up leadership in that I was not aware of, and I was very hungry to say, well, what am I doing that's creating and causing turbulence as well as my perception that other people are? So that's how I got here, and I have a passion for helping other people develop that larger systems awareness, to see the big picture, to see the larger context of group dynamics and system dynamics. So it's a long answer to question, Jen, and anyway, I'll leave it there. Feel free to follow up if you have something there.
And we have a couple of other questions in the queue, so maybe we can move on to those and then get back to your follow-up or your other questions.
That's fine.
Okay.
Hi, this is Bella. My question,
Hi.
My question kind of relates to the last example you were giving of working within different cultures and how that affects being able to come to a shared task. Because earlier you were talking about systems emergence within and how it can be an organic process within different kinds of groups. And the challenge arises when you're moving to larger communities. And I imagine within larger communities, more complexities, whether it's a large difference in ethnic backgrounds and religious beliefs and whatnot. So I wanted to know if this type of approach is being used in mediation and conflict resolution, and if it is, if you had an example, or, you know, if it's not being used, what you think about possibly the future of that in this field.
Right. The Yvonne frames functional subgrouping in part as a conflict resolution tool. And while I don't know if people who are sort of formally hanging out their shingle as conflict resolution managers, the reality is that it's a constant part of any time that we are working with the group, is the awareness that that's one of the group's biggest challenges, is when they go into conflict, how can they slow it down, normalize it, accept it as important and meaningful, and work their way through it. I've been in groups as large as 150 using the subgrouping methodology, and it is powerful in that context. So it can be used in larger communities. And the whole idea of integrating different ethnicities and cultural norms is really, very profound. I was just working with a couple and helping them look at the different norms they had in doing the dishes, and there's a kind of a joke in my world where communes rose and fall over who would do the dishes or who would not do the dishes. So a small task like that can create enormous conflict, and one of the ways to start to unpack that is to help identify the norms that our subcultures have that often clash. And once we name those norms and explore them, we can start to see, oh yeah, I'm operating from certain assumptions, and this person is operating from certain assumptions. Is there a meeting point? But often those assumptions are unconscious, that we're not aware of them. So we sort of jump right into our reactivity without seeing where our norms come from. So that's the best answer I have in the moment for your question. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Hi, Peter. This is Gayatri. Thank you so much for your insights, and I'm so taken back to my experience at a lawyer's office. It was a divorce attorney, and every other application that used to come in for divorce would have this, they would have all these grounds for divorce. And there was this one small ground for divorce which would say irreconcilable differences. And
yeah.
Almost all the time, that would be checked. You know, it's these differences. As much as it is so powerful a challenge to overcome the differences, at the same time, it's like it absolutely kind of sometimes just bogs you down. So when you say that, you know, this conflict, this differences are is a phase of development, it kind of gives a hope, and it's kind of a way of looking at things positively, you know, that there's something to learn from it, you can grow from it. So thank you for that. And my question was, if you could just explain a little bit more about what this subgrouping means, I'm really not getting a good hold on it. So if you could just explain a little bit more about that.
Yes, and I can join you that it's hard to get a sense of it to describe, and then in a group it becomes very apparent very quickly. So
okay.
Let's say if I'm working in a group of people, everybody's sitting in a circle,
mm-hmm.
and one person will say something like, oh, tonight I'm sad, and I feel it in my chest. And
mm-hmm.
then their job is to say, anybody else? And that anybody else is a key communication bit that does two things. It lets people know when you're finished, and it actively invites other people to join that person on a similar experience of sadness.
Okay.
So then in a group, anybody who notices that they feel sadness or something like it is invited to join, and they don't have to, but they can if they want. So first one person might join, and the instruction is to join. Yeah, I notice my sadness, and then to build, to add another bit. So
mm-hmm.
I feel my sadness, and I can notice a lump in my throat. Anybody else?
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody else might join and say, I can join, I feel sad, and I feel tears, and my heart is opening. And then maybe the first person comes back in and says, yeah, and as you bring in your tears, I can feel my tears, and I get the image of a pool of water. Anybody else? And this way of joining and layering more information with those who organically want to join means
mm-hmm.
maybe I'm looking at two or three or four people in a group. Let's say the group is maybe 10 people. So we've formed a subgroup within the larger group that is exploring something.
Okay.
And then maybe there are four or five or six people who aren't joining. They're listening, they're watching, they're attending to themselves. They might be noticing if they feel sad. They might be noticing that they feel different. Maybe they're happy, or maybe they're neutral, or maybe they're noticing something more reactive or irritated happening. And then, so after that subgroup works for a while, and I'm describing a therapy group in the moment, not necessarily a work group. But then another subgroup might start,
okay.
and the first subgroup will pause, and the new subgroup will work, and it will work for a while, and then, as an organic process, different things can happen. Sometimes the two subgroups merge. Sometimes new subgroups form.
Okay.
sometimes the whole group comes into one large group and works organically around something. And that's the property of emergence that's always unfolding as we take this process into a group. In a task group, you might, let's say you have a proposal, and the leader of the group might say something like, okay, so we have a proposal. Let's first hear all the people who have similarities to this proposal, who can join this proposal, and let's wait until we have all the joins in the room before we hear people who have reservations.
Uh-huh.
So you bring in all the energy about what's similar. I like this proposal. It works for me, blah, 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 blah. People join. And then you make a boundary and say, okay, now we're ready to hear the differences. All the people who notice they have an objection or a concern, let's surface those. So
okay.
By creating a boundary between the people who can join a proposal and those who notice they have reactions to it, you avoid going into a fight in a group. And then something interesting very often happens in the decision-making process is that the two groups are more able to influence each other when you do it this way. So that what often happens is when this group that's holding the differences or the objections, if they work deeply enough, they begin to surface organic solutions or modifications to a proposal so that an organic solution begins to emerge rather than a fight around differences.
Okay. Very nice. Thank you. So you're suggesting that both the groups become like observers of the differences that are coming up.
Exactly.
Okay.
And they're in a sort of self-reflective, contained process.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the question.
I have a question, unless you do, Chris.
Please pick up because you were in a process earlier.
Okay, thanks. Peter, you also do consultations for organizations, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Going on-site or they come to you?
Either way.
Okay. So maybe you could just paint a picture for us. Having worked in organizations and been an HR manager, usually people don't call in a consultant until they know something's going down and we better fix it fast. So clearly emotions can run very high. There's lots of power at stake, lots of hidden agendas. Could you walk us through how does somebody start to use you? But let's take it right from the beginning. Who typically is the person who's going to reach out to you? How do you go in there to prepare the participants? Can you make this as real life an explanation as you can so we can actually see if you're in an organization, I'm the administrative assistant, you're going to come in and help us, what can I expect from you?
I'll do my best, Jen. There's a lot in your question. And one is to make a distinction, and I would also begin to offer this distinction to the people that I'm consulting with. If it's somebody who's come to me and say, we're thinking of hiring you, what would you do? Or they've hired me and we're trying to set out a plan, is to help them start to separate out what we call task versus process. So in an organization, there are explicit tasks that everyone, at least in principle, is trying to accomplish together. What happens is that in the service of task, the underlying process is alive and well. So in an organization, while everybody has an explicit role, and they're working toward tasks, internally, people are in survival when they're in conflict. There are There's competition around resources, around respect, around any number of things. People are anxious about their job. They're worried if they're going to be promoted or fired or liked or any number of kinds of inner process experiences. So I would say to them something like, well, okay, so you have explicit tasks that everybody agrees is an important thing. And then you have this implicit process that's cooking underneath. And our goal is to help you get back to being able to work towards your tasks together. And let's see if we can find out what gets in the way of that work happening. And one of the anxiety in organizations is that you're going to come in and do therapy with them rather than help them stay on task. And the goal is to functionally address process material parsimoniously enough so that it can move without devolving into a therapy kind of process, depending on the organization and its willingness to do that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
So you start with a simple task that there might be one of the ways to lower defensiveness in a system is just to start, you called me in because you guys have problems and you're having a tough time. I wonder what it is that you guys do well together.
Mm-hmm.
And then I might have them begin to subgroup about what they do well. And if I'm lucky, and the group is lucky, that will help people start to see things in a new way. To recognize that they do things well, and they can talk to each other without going into conflict. So that's not the only game in town. And then we could say, after we've built the climate and lightened it up a little bit or opened it up a little bit, let's begin to look at what the things are that get in the way for you. Can people start to then name what are the challenges that come up for them that keeps them from working toward their task? Well, I'm anxious about my job, or I'm really frustrated with the boss, or I'm frustrated that people don't take their jobs and do them, or whatever it might be. And you get a list of the things that they don't that get in the way, and then you ask the group to say, well, which of these would you like to begin to start to work on? Which one of these seems like a manageable bite for us to pick up and then see if we can get some success in lowering the restraining forces to you guys working together well? So in that way, we're trying to take a huge problem, what might be, and chunk it down into a smaller bit that is going to be more manageable. And then we might start to subgroup around that particular item and surface in the climate of finding similarities what the problem is. And then if we're lucky, people are able to explore charged items in a more organic and lower stress way and find similarities with each other when they only perceive differences. And that opens up barriers of communication and feeling and new solutions. So that's a kind of a spirit in which I go into an organization. And if we're lucky enough to work over time, then we would just keep picking tasks or picking the things that get in the way and then helping them get better at reducing those restraining forces. With an eye that some groups are willing to do deep work if they get far along and feel some success. And that deeper work would be to start to look at the roles that people get stuck in with each other that are repetitive patterns, some of them going back to childhood, some of them surfacing simply within the sort of life of the organization. And so if we're lucky enough to work over time, people can start to unpick some pretty deep material that then frees the system to move forward towards its task.
That sounds great. Thank you so much. That was a wonderful answer.
Oh, great, Jan. I'm glad it got to where you were curious about.
Yes, it did indeed. Thanks.
Peter, I want to ask you more about leadership, because you mentioned the authority issue first as kind of like, the big kahuna of, what you get down to when you go in this process. And so if you could I want to phrase this question carefully too, especially in the service space context, because it's an unusual group here that doesn't have very many explicit leaders. It's non-hierarchical to an extent. So I wonder if you could talk about leadership a bit and what models of leadership you see as working well in terms of avoiding some of the common pitfalls that you see. Does that make sense?
Well, I can see if we can start to come at it. The essence of the authority issue, in a sense, in a deep level, is that the world is not how you or I want it to be. It's frustrating. And how do I organize my energy to help happen what I think is important to happen? And so there's something about learning to manage frustration and stay alive to your goals, stay oriented to your goals. And that's true if you're a member of an organization. And it's also true if you're taking up leadership of any kind in an organization. And I distinguish between two kinds of leadership. One is the organic leadership that comes from any member of a system. You can call it emergent leadership, organic leadership, leadership that arises, in a sense, from the bottom up. And that kind of leadership has its own challenges. The other kind of leadership is where, in the service of the kind of structure that an organization works with, there are some either transitory or permanent roles that people have that they take up leadership. That's maybe true in a level organization, a non-hierarchical organization. There are different roles. And it can also be true in other kinds of organizations where there's some kind of hierarchy. And as an example, one of the things that I do in my psychotherapy groups is I just spell out, there are members in this group, and then there's the leader. I'm the leader, and I do leadership behaviors, and you're members, and you do member behaviors. And we learn a lot from simply naming those two kinds of behaviors. Understandably, in a group, sometimes people's competitive forces get going, and they start to take on leadership behaviors that would potentially be disruptive. And so then there's a chance to train somebody about, okay, what role are you in? Are you a member? Are you a leader? And is your behavior functional within your role? So, in a sense, to be a leader, you're starting to train yourself about roles and functional behaviors inside of roles. And that kind of abstract language sounds kind of dull at first, but it ends up helping a group get functional boundaries and functional lines of authority rather than imposed either by the group dynamic. A fight in a group is a kind of effort to impose one's own opinion or feelings into a group, or through a distortion of functional roles into power plays or critical bullying leadership versus responsive, attuned leadership. And the thing that I bring to leadership is an awareness of our huge tasks inside to deal with our own authority issues, which can fall on not taking up authority and going passive, or it can fall into being overly assertive and aggressive. And that's a lifelong journey, as many of you know, to grapple with one's own authority issue. I know it's been a lifelong journey for me. Mm-hmm. And the power of the SCT approach is that it gives me a non-judgmental frame and a level of abstraction that helps me look at the function of my behavior rather than to personalize it. And if I get that training, and I surely to this day get consultation and training on my leadership, it's a, you know, these dynamics are deep and ongoing, and we need support if we take up leadership. It's very challenging.
Mm-hmm. Peter, thanks so much for that answer. We're running up against the end of our available time. And Chris, did you have a closing comment?
Thanks for asking. Yeah, I know we are just at our time boundary, and I wanted to name how I've experienced Peter ending groups, which I think is sort of a beautiful ending ritual. There's also a centering starting ritual too, which I'm sad we didn't mention. But the ending ritual is to notice any surprises, learnings, discoveries, dissatisfactions or satisfactions that have come up for you. And we won't have time now for folks to chime in on that, but maybe as a something to take away with what you might have learned, what you might have discovered within yourself, what may have surprised you, what was dissatisfying, what you felt satisfied about. And I discovered that talking about SCT over the phone is very challenging. I so want us to be in person and sort of just doing subgrouping instead of talking about it. And I'm also very, really satisfied at the intricate maps that you were able to weave for us, Peter. I learned new things myself. So I'm really grateful for your time and for everyone's energies who helped build our little ad hoc system here.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, everybody. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much.